tonight on Arena. Alicia Vikander on her latest movie, Firebrand, and David Bulger on Dancehall Blues, a show to celebrate 30 years of Cush Kame. +51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. The Dublin Fringe Festival is celebrating its 30th year, as is Cush Kame Dance Theatre. There's a joint celebration of birthdays in the upcoming Dublin Fringe Festival when Cush Kame host Dancehall Blues at its headquarters in Fairview. The piece, Dancehall Blues, is choreographed by Cush Kame founder and artistic director David Bulger, and is performed by Alex O'Neill and Stephanie Dufresne, who come from very different dance disciplines, as we will hear. I'm delighted to be joined in studio this evening by both David and Stephanie. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
David Bulger.
Thanks very much.
That 30 years went fast, didn't it?
It certainly did. Yeah, so much has happened. It's been quite some journey. So we're still here, which is incredible, you know. And all the artists that we've worked with. So, when you start celebrating your 30th year, you realise the amount of people that we've worked with and that have, you know, made the shows and made films and all of the adventures. And then we get to do a new show, which is brilliant, but it's like you're starting all over again, you know, because it's always start again and you're going, will this work? And all that kind of worry. So it kind of constantly puts it up to you, you know.
Yeah.
And I think as time goes by, you know, people go, oh, you've loads of experience. That must be nothing to you now. And you just realise that actually the older you get, the kind of harder it gets, or you know more about what could possibly go wrong. I think when you're younger, you're kind of a bit reckless. You go, yeah, we'll do it, you know.
Yeah, you don't have to think, you know, have I got more ideas?
Well, that's the thing, yes. Hopefully.
Now, I suppose what I mean is when you were younger,
whatever
comes next, I'll do it. But now you kind of have to maybe a bit more forward planning or whatever.
Yeah.
However, let us talk about the specifics of Dancehall Blues. And I guess the fact that you're putting it on in your own HQ, your own headquarters, is kind of, that in itself is a statement. Did that strike you quite quickly, quite early on as a venue?
It did, because it's a beautiful building, and it was built in 1889, I believe, and it was built as a postal sorting office in Fairview, which would have been at that time at the outskirts of Dublin, you know, it would have been just outside the city. And before we moved into the building, it was a bridal shop, and used to have four wedding dresses in the front windows, and much loved, and I believe much missed the wedding dresses in the bridal shop. So actually, during Culture Night, we're going to reinstate the bridal dresses in the front windows, just for old time's sake.
And did you know that? Like, had you as a young fella driven past or walked past that building? You knew the building and you knew the bridal shop.
I did, and I never dreamt that we would.
Have a dance company based there.
I really didn't. And I moved over towards East Wall a few years ago, and we were looking for a new studio. And because I was looking for a house on the north side, I had been on the south side, and I'd crossed the river and I was ready to embrace everything. And I just started to look around, and it was the second building that came up on the listing. And I cycled over to it and I had a look, and I went, oh, if only we could have that building, it would be incredible. And lo and behold, I put it out there, and we started to negotiate with the landlord, and we had an agent working with us on it. And the landlord really was into the arts, and we told him our plans, and he looked at our work, and we got talking, and we got the tenancy of the building, and it was renovated. It was slightly different than the way it is now. And we built the studio at the back, and we've kind of an atrium space, and we've an admin space. And it's, as I say, it is a landmark building, and it's beautiful. So I wanted to open up and share that with as many people in the community as possible, because I think people need to see it. And I know the local community loved the building. amazing because we've had people come in and visit and say, can I hug the walls? I love the walls. It really is loved, you know.
Well, so. There you go. For you, Stephanie, I mean, in terms of your career, how important a dance company in Ireland for you as a dancer is Cush Kim, given that David is sitting there beside you.
Oh my God.
You know,
no pressure at all.
I mean, I think, you know, they're one of the biggest, and like I've worked quite a bit in Ireland. Like I came home about 9 years ago, but I certainly, speaking for myself and Alex, I would imagine I really appreciate working with someone like David because of the breadth of experience he has. It's hard to find that sometimes in a small country, you know, and I really feel when I'm working with David, I'm like, I'm learning, I'm writing things down, I'm learning stuff every day. And that's just a gift. Like, so yeah, it's a joy to work for Cush Kim. I mean, I lived in Fairview in 2020 and 2021, and I used to walk past that building and think, what a gorgeous building. And then I saw the Cush Kim notice logo. Go up and I went, this is great. Yeah.
So you knew it as a building before it was the Cush Kim.
I just thought it was lovely. Yeah. And I was just happened to be living in Fairview and I would walk past the building. And then when I saw it, I went, oh, that's a great use of that space.
You mentioned Alex there, Alex being Alex O'Neill. I mentioned it. I said in the introduction that yourself and Alex come from very different dance disciplines. It might be easy for you to describe his, but tell us about how you describe your dance discipline and how it differs from Alex, would you say?
Wow, that's a great question. Because it's hard to describe yourself sometimes. Alex likes me to refer to him as the bad boy of contemporary dance. And what I think he means by that is he's a beautiful contemporary dancer, but he comes from hip hop, street dance, commercial, jazz. Whereas I trained in Rotterdam. Actually, I started training in ballet, to be honest, in Galway with Judith.
Don't tell me you're going to call yourself the good girl of contemporary dance, are you?
No, but I suppose I have a more classical training than... No, by no means am I the good girl, but... I have, you know, I trained in classical ballet, and I went to Rotterdam, I trained in contemporary dance. And so I suppose, but I think, you know, dancer to dancer, like our training is to pick up new styles very fast. So I would like to think both Alex and I are very versatile performers, but certainly different movers, which is one of the great joys, I suppose, of getting to work with you.
I guess when you, if cast is the right word for dancer, but I guess it is the right word for choosing your two dancers for this particular part of the show and this big duet moment, I know, within the show as well, David, you must have had that rubbing together of the two styles very much in your mind.
Yeah, because I'd worked with Stephanie separately to Alex, and I just thought the two of them would be great. I didn't know that they hadn't worked together before. And I think with a duet, you really need to get two people that can complement each other and also maybe push the choreographic language a little bit. And also that they're both great actors. Stephanie's a great singer. She's what we call the triple threat. She can sing, dance and act and very well. And I always like to include people's skills in a piece because I think it's a great way of storytelling. And with a duet, you know, you can only dance for so long before you have to. So there's kind of ways of telling the story that we're telling through the body, but also through their acting skills.
So on stage, is it just Stephanie and Alex?
Yeah.
It's pretty, sure. We'll be grand, Sean. We'll be grand. Hang on, just getting there, building up the stamina.
I was wondering about the music. Let's have a listen to this.
Ne me quitte pas, il faut oublier, tout peut s'oublier. Qui s'enfuit déjà, oubliez le temps des malentendus et le temps perdu, à savoir comment oublier ces heures qui tuent parfois à coups de pourquoi le cœur du bonheur ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas, ne me quitte pas.
Stephanie Dufresne, a triple threat in more than one language, clearly,
get out of
as well.
Here, Sean, get out of here.
So that is actually you singing
as part of
the show.
Yes, as part of the show. You have to do a lot of things to make a living in this industry, Sean. I like to keep it fresh. Yeah, that's me singing, which I really enjoy. Yeah.
Singing and dancing at the same time. Are you living? So, but it's interesting that very lyrical, I know there's great sadness and heart and soul in the piece, obviously, but that very lyrical piece then is the piece that has been handed over to, in inverted commas, the street hip-hop dancer.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, Alex is a beautiful dancer. You know, he's, I think you'd be doing him a disservice to say he's just a street dancer. You know what I mean? He's stunning. Yeah. But yeah, he does a really poignant, well, I feel kind of heart-driven solo to this.
Well, I'm guessing, David, that was part of your mind, because as I'm saying that, the presumption I'm giving, the cliched idea of the street dancer, you think, oh yeah, the swift moves, you know, rough, ready, but very, very vibrant. But that's very lyrical. So you were looking for us to maybe rethink, I guess, what we think about street dance and hip hop.
Yeah, I suppose I because I know Alex, that you know, I knew that he could express himself in a lyrical way, and also that the two of them together in the studio, kind of, you know, bouncing off each other, you know, you learn an awful lot. But also actually the street dance, I mean, any of the street dancers that I know, there's an incredible array of talent here. And some of it is, some of the talent is very raw, and some of it's extremely advanced. And I've really started to get to know that community, and it really interests me because of all the different styles and how people kind of navigate towards a certain thing, like crumping or popping or locking. And you realise that they're all telling stories. Every single move is part of a story. So,
and I guess the recent break, wasn't it just simply called Break in the Olympics, the type of dance that we were getting there? Is that in the general area of what we're talking about?
Well, I think with Alex, he comes more from the crumping background, which is kind of a very rapid, excessive storytelling movement. Mm. It's generally not choreographed, actually, when it's done. I mean, the certain moves that you have to do, stomping and swinging of the arms and popping the chest and all. But if you kind of break it down, it's very much about telling a story, which I'm obviously very interested in. And I think when you start to see that, you realise, wow, all this communication going on is very interesting.
And I think you used the word communication there, and I think that's part of what you wanted to get into as well, was this, that it was the building was a post office.
Yeah, well, just at the back of the head note was that, you know, I thought how many letters might have gone through the hands of the postal sorting working officers that were people communicating in a romantic way. And then I was trying to think of the idea of the dance hall, about, was it real or was it imagined? And that kind of fine line between fact and fiction. So it has...
So there's some kind of dystopian feel to the dance hall, is there?
There is a dystopian feel. It's deliberately ambiguous about the nature of the relationship with the dancers and the dance hall, and with each other, actually, and what is outside. There's a whole pressure from the outside of the building that we learn later in the piece that becomes quite a protagonist in it, I hope. And there's a lot of magic and illusion and sleight of hand. I was given a magic set when I was 7 years of age, a Paul Daniels magic set, and I was obsessed with magic and the idea of illusion. So I wanted to kind of use that sense of sleight of hand and illusion to explore the idea of what is real, what is unreal, what are dreams, what are... So it has a kind of a feeling. I was inspired by the film Melancholia by Lars von Trier, which is a, you know, planet is hurtling towards the Earth, and within the concept he kind of figures out the humanity and the empathy in humans, and I wanted to really pick up on that.
And for you, Stephanie, I guess, you know, coming from that classical and contemporary background and then working alongside Alex like this, has do you feel it has affected and changed the, obviously whoever you're opposite it does, but how has it affected and changed the way you're dancing in this show?
Yeah, that's a great question. Like, I really like, I think one of the beauties of contemporary dance is you're learning, different choreographers have different styles, so my training was to absorb and imitate different movement physicalities kind of on the hop. And similarly, Alex has a very kind of articulate, sharp style, let's say, that, so, you know, that's one thing that's lovely about contemporary dance is I'm sharing my movement with him, he's sharing his movement with me, David is sharing his movement. But, you know, inherently, I suppose it's also just two individuals meeting in space, and whether that's a play or dance, that's the part I really love about it, you know. And I think, I guess we're just lucky that Alex and I have lovely chemistry in the room.
And it's all about communication, storytelling, and doing that through dance. That's what you've been doing for 30 years now. And even before that, you were doing it.
Probably.
Well, maybe in another 30, who knows? See you in 30 years' time.
Whoa.
David Bolger and Stephanie Dufresne there. Thanks so much to both of you for coming in. Dance Hall Blues will be at the Cushcombe Dance Theatre headquarters. That's at 42 Fairview Strand.
That's it.
And it's from September the 6th through until the 21st. Fringefest.com for full details. Hollywood superstar, occasional musician and now author Keanu Reeves has co-written a novel about an immortal warrior with one of science fiction's most acclaimed authors, China Mieville. Declan Burke has been reading The Book of Elsewhere and he joins us now. I suppose, Declan, it's hardly a surprise that when Keanu Reeves goes to write something, it's in the area of science fiction. Although, are we almost actually in a world of fantasy and mythology in this?
We absolutely are. And as you say, Keanu Reeves' form when it comes to sci-fi, the big breakthrough was with Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, which
not
some people...
Not science fiction, I wouldn't have thought.
Well, I'm claiming it, Sean. It's a movie about time travelling, so I'm claiming it for science fiction.
All right.
But there's Johnny Mnemonic, there's the Daily Earth Stud Sale, and of course The Matrix, which is the daddy of all the sci-fi over the last 30 years. So you're dead right. It is a science fiction novel, but because of the kind of character who is the central player, a character called Unyut, who is effectively an unkillable warrior who has been around for 80,000 years, that definitely leans very heavily into the world of fantasy. And the idea of mythology is very much explored in the novel.
The character is a prose realization of a previous comic book character that Reeves had been involved in making as well. The character was simply called B. That was a series called Berserker with no vowels at all.
Yes, the cool people don't use vowels.
Oh, I see.
Sean. And B is short for that Berserker, all right. And he's not just an immortal warrior, this character. When he finds himself in a war scenario or a combat scenario, he goes into these kind of Berserker warp spasms, which we tend to associate with the Viking warriors and so forth, or even our own Cú Chulainn. So that was co-created by Keanu Reeves and the comic book series was drawn by Ron Garney. This goes back to 2021, which was started by a Kickstarter which raised over nearly $1.5 million.
Did he not have the money in his back pocket? No,
I have no insight into Keanu Reeves' finances, Sean. You'll have to take that up with Keanu himself. But it was hugely successful. Over 600,000 copies of the first issue alone was sold, which is very, very impressive. So there, as a result of that, there has been a Netflix adaptation suggested, and in tandem with that, we have this novel, The Book of Elsewhere.
Say the name of the character again.
The
character that that we
Unyut.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that.
You're very kind.
So Unyut has been around for quite a while, 80,000 years.
Yeah, he's described in the synopsis as an eternal warrior. Now, the pedants among us might say it's only been 80,000 years. What's he talking about? But yeah, this is his big selling point, that he is effectively unkillable. Now, technically speaking, we can kill Unyut, but he will very shortly regenerate afterwards and come back fully formed from a rather messy egg and so forth. That idea of the 80,000 years, and you reference mythology in the introduction, that's what gives this story for me one of the most interesting aspects, because we do get flashbacks and digressions to his previous existences, can we say, and we go all the way back into prehistory and the mists of time. When the character of Unyut becomes a kind of a proto-mythotype out of which the likes of Heracles or Thor or all these kind of famous characters from mythology emerge due to kind of primitive peoples encountering this unkillable warrior. So Keanu Reeves and China Mieville, they have quite a bit of fun with that and exploring that kind of mythological aspect.
But, you know, the idea that somebody who is immortal kind of gets a bit fed up with all of that and says, do you know what, I'd be quite happy to be mortal. that is hardly something new, and it needs to be treated in some kind of interesting way. Is it treated interestingly here?
It is, and sometimes a little too interesting for my taste. So the sense that we're giving, with the LA Times kind of looked into this, and Keanu Reeves has provided the outline for this, China Miéville, who is a very well-respected science fiction or speculative fiction author. He describes himself as weird fiction is what he writes. He holds the record for winning the Arthur C. Clarke Award 3 times. Mm. Beautiful stylist, brings very interesting concepts to his own work. And what he does is he provides lots of interesting digressions away from, as you're suggesting, the central plot in this is pretty straightforward. Unkillable warrior meets foe, defeats foe, moves on. Occasionally killed, regenerates, moves on. So what China Miéville does is he provides us with lots of interesting kind of digressions into mythology, into teleology, into philosophy, psychology, as the character Von Newt starts to explore his own nature. What is he composed of? What is he made of? His mother's prayers on lightning strike, apparently, initially. I'm not sure if that would stand up, if scrupulously examined by science. But he wants to know what his purpose, if any, is. Is he an accident? Is he a freak of nature? And this is where the book, for me, becomes really interesting. Because to a certain extent, he is an extreme example of the kind of mortal's longing for immortality. Yeah. But what Unyu does is kind of the character turns that back on itself, because when you do possess immortality with no prospect of ever dying, it tends to take the flavour out of all your experiences and being alive and so forth. So he's very clear when he is being interviewed by a psychologist who is head of a study group that is trying to figure out what he is. He has no craving to die. He's not suicidal, but what he does want is a sense of an ending, a sense of an awareness of what it might mean to be mortal.
Well, I suppose it's important because we're talking a lot about mythology here, and people might have a feeling that this book is set in mythological times, but in fact, it's set in the present day. We're meeting him. Is it in 2023 or somewhere, in and around now?
Or maybe even
2024.
In the future, exactly that. He is. So at this point, having been kind of championed as a warrior for various empires and races, and the whole way through his 80,000 years, he is currently the focus of a secretive US Army Armed Forces group. And they're utilizing his unkillable ability and his ability to turn berserker. They will parachute him into some perilous situation and to exfiltrate, American citizens or put down a rising or a riot or whatever it happens to be. And at the same time, they're studying him to see what he's made of, because if they can figure out how to create their own unused, they will have an army of super soldiers, and then we're looking at a whole other way of policing the world. But as I say, Unyu kind of resists that, because when he doesn't know himself what he is, he's very reluctant to unleash an army of himself on an unsuspecting planet.
So that is the present moment of it.
Indeed.
And is he fighting a foe or a set of foes in the present
moment? Well, there are a series of foes that come along that are to be defeated. There is a rather unusual one, which is a Babirusa, which is a deer pig native to Indonesia, and which is created at the same instant that Unyu is himself 80,000 years ago, and who takes
prayers,
one look at
him. Prayers and a bit of lightning involved.
Apparently
there as well.
Apparently so. No definitive proof. But he takes one look at Unyu and lunges at him with these outrageous tusks, and Unyu kills him in the moment of his... And the Babirusa does not take kindly to this at all.
So Babirusa similarly
can
regenerate.
It also regenerates over the 80,000 years, and every 1,000 or maybe 10,000 years, they come together. It's almost verging on a Monty Python sketch. They come together and they clash, and the poor old pig gets vanquished once more, and off it goes and comes back even more annoyed with its immortal foe. But more interestingly, I think, in terms of the novel, is that very early on, we realised there is a kind of coalition of conservative religious types and radical scientists. And
because
in the contemporary moment, because what Unyu represents is, he seems to defy the laws of science and God alike with this kind of apparent immortality, and it flies in the face of everything that civilization stands for. So there is this secretive cabal that has got together, and somehow or another they are going to destroy him.
Two things that I want to mention specifically with an Irish connection. We mentioned Berserkers, which is very close, of course, to Cuchulainn's famous warp spasm. Do they meet, or was it just that Unuit was a pal or knew Cuchulainn, met him back in the mists of time?
He did meet him back in the mists of time. His description is rather pithy. I met Cuchulainn. He was an asshole, according to Unuit. Yeah.
Oh, that's as much as Irish mythology gets. Does he go any deeper than that?
We have no idea what Cuchulainn's opinion of Unuit was, but maybe there'll be a sequel in which that will be made clear.
And his second Irish connection, am I right, or have I misplaced this somehow? Did Unuit perform in Crap's Last Tape at some point along the way?
It's because of the nature of the character played by, or the nature of the character that Crap is, that he identifies.
Oh, right.
With the character of Crap. So,
who's looking back at his previous life in the Beckett play.
Absolutely.
Right.
And that's one of the interesting things, because he's been around for 80,000 years, he has explored virtually every tiny crevice of art, culture, science, you name it. This guy is a very well-read immortal warrior.
And a fan of Beckett and Crap's Last Tape.
Why wouldn't he be?
Now, is it worth... I was expecting a big tome. It's actually reasonably cool. Maybe 300 pages.
It is, but the print is quite dense, I have to say. It might take you quite a while to get through it. It offers an awful lot, Sean. You mentioned science fiction and fantasy. It covers a lot of bases. If you're a fan of the kind of straightforward action-adventure thriller with plenty of blood and gore, you will be well satisfied. If you're more interested in hard science and philosophical thinking, it will also deliver on that. Maybe a little overwritten in places for my particular taste, but I think a lot of fans are going to
and
really like this.
And briefly and finally, is it written by Chiny Miéville with Keanu Reeves putting his name to it? Although Miéville would have his own set of followings anyway.
Well, it cuts both ways. I, as far as I know, Keanu Reeves has come up with the concept and delivered Chiny Miéville to write the text. Yeah. But Chiny Miéville, who is a novelist, has also written or drawn comic books. So there's a mutual influencing, a cross-hatching that's going on here, I think.
And the Netflix film, I think, is already kind of...
It's in process.
Maybe more to do with the comic than the novel itself.
I would think a lot of what's good about the novel might be excised for the sake of a film adaptation.
That's Declan Burke speaking to us about The Book of Elsewhere by Keanu Reeves and Chiny Miéville. It's published by Del Rey. Henry VIII of England and his six wives has been the subject of much historical fiction and film and TV series, most notably, I suppose, recently The Tudors Made in Ireland and the BBC's adaptation of Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall. Now comes Firebrand, film based on the novel The Queen's Gambit by Elizabeth Freemantle. Film not about the queens who Henry had beheaded, Anne Boleyn or Catherine Howard, but his last wife and the woman who would outlive him, Catherine Parr. In the film Firebrand, directed by Karim Aynouz, the King is played by Jude Law and Queen Catherine by Alicia Vikander. The plot takes some factual leaps for sure in the telling of Catherine's story, but it does accurately paint a picture of 16th century England in religious turmoil, where progressive thinkers want to follow the Protestant faith and break away from the Catholic Church. Catherine Parr is one of these thinkers, but her husband, the now ageing and ulcer-ridden king, is out to rid England of heretical beliefs. Keir Sheehy recently spoke to Alicia Vikander about her role as Catherine Parr in Firebrand.
Hi, Alicia. You're so welcome on Arena.
Thank you.
Now, divorce beheaded, died, divorce beheaded, survived. That's the old rhyme to do with the wives of Henry VIII. And there's a belief out there that because Catherine Parr survived Henry VIII as his sixth wife, that she was the king's carer in his old age and in his dotage. But that's not really the way it was.
Well, I mean, it was probably a little bit of the case, as we often say in our film, for sure. You know, I think she was known to be, you know, someone who was a great carer, and she was also known to be a great mother figure. And she obviously didn't have her own children, but she did raise Elizabeth. She was, but also very known to be an extremely, you know, intelligent woman. She was a good Christian, But one of the things that I thought was pretty remarkable when I read the script and that I actually didn't even know about myself was, you know, the fact that this woman actually did rule Britain for a short while, and that she also was Britain's first ever woman to be published under her own name, with controversial ideal, especially in the ears of Henry at that time.
My love, look at this beauty.
Did you do it?
Huh?
And ask you, did they burn her?
What, the preacher woman? Oh. Hey, that's godless business.
Oh. You would never do anything without asking you first.
Oh, kids. What's this woman to you? She was a radical. She deserted her husband, her children. She was a fanatic, preaching...
Her death is on your soul.
Don't question us. And don't speak of our soul. Don't ask you wanted the king dead. Is that what you want? You don't want any harm to come to me.
No.
You don't want to hurt
me. No, never.
Let's begin again.
As you say, on the one hand, she's in this powerful situation with the king because he's given her his realm as he goes off to fight a war in Europe. And then on the other hand, we see her in a very dangerous situation where she's associating with a known heretic, Anne Askew. Can you tell us how she finds herself in this very precarious situation?
Well, she was forced to marry the king. That was, you know, it was... She was picked, and that's what you kind of have to understand with not just this situation, but then also kind of the situation women in general, what they experience at this time in history. I mean, obviously for her, she was probably spending most of her days, you know, unconsciously, you know, fearing the fact that she could be killed off, considering all the executions that happened at the court regularly. But then I think, you know, it's remarkable what people can go through, what they can cope with, and then also what she actually managed to accomplish whilst being under such threat. And I think it's interesting how, you know, human beings, she almost, I assume that's what I felt when I prepared for the role and when we were shooting. It's like, you also kind of have to justify your own role and why you were there. And in one way, I think she took it upon herself to kind of take on the role as a queen with, you know, with everything that she had and could, and did it, you know, did a pretty extremely remarkable job and managed to keep Henry on her side, and I can just assume that that was a daily chess game.
Yes, because there is a wonderful scene between you as the Queen, Catherine, and Anne Askew, and she is kind of pushing back on the Queen's because she believes totally in this new religion sweeping Europe, Protestantism, and she knows that the Catherine believes in this too, but she believes that she should just kill the king and leave. She's really threatening Catherine, whereas Catherine's trying to negotiate this very, very difficult situation.
We must rise up and take what is ours. Confidence in your weakness is what keeps you safe.
What would you have me do?
I would have you pull his head from his neck.
Yeah, I think, you know, they're working, you know, just different ways. And I think that's an understanding somewhere, probably deep down between the two women as well. I think there's part of Catherine that probably wishes that she had the kind of loud voice and capability that Anne had, but she's also been given, you know, the kind of God's chosen will to become the queen. And obviously with whatever thing that comes with that and the history of where the previous wives have ended up, I mean, she was able to do, and especially like the fact that she managed to publish some of these texts and being married to Henry, you know, to me just shows what, you know, how progressive and hardworking she actually was.
Yes, because it is those scenes with the king, played by Jude Law, and they're claustrophobic scenes. You and the king, surrounded by his courtiers sometimes. And it is so brutal. He's such a vile person. What was it like to film those scenes?
First of all, I mean, the first day when I got to see Jude Law, I kind of knew that I was expecting a pretty remarkable transformation. And he's such an incredible actor. That was a big part why I wanted to do this. He was already attached, and I just knew he would make something pretty extraordinary. And he did that. I think he showed quite a different side, maybe, to Henry than what we've already also seen on screen.
Is it true that he made himself even less attractive than normal? Was he stinking?
You know, obviously he's telling in this film a story about a man in his last few days. And he had been obviously fighting this ulcer for about 10 years. And he knows that he's close to meeting his maker at this point. So that also, I guess, you know, in a very human way, start to bring out quite a bit of vulnerability. Jude did, you know, it was remarkable to see this transformation. And during the press, a lot of people have been wanting to talk about the smells that he brought on set to kind of give a sense of what the smells would have been like in these rooms. From a very early beginning, the conversations that Jude and Kareem and I had was that we wanted to tell this from like quite a domestic point of view, quite horrific moments between them two, and therefore also, you know, tell it with a lot of human accuracy and truth. And then you also, you know, I think considering the history of women, but also the reality of relationships that exists, you know, today, tragically, we also wanted to tell it with accuracy, you know, to not shy away from these scenes, to really, like, I think we all felt we had to go to certain places to a certain extent. But then also, I mean, Jude and I was actually laughing. We had a lot of press, you know, in two different rooms when we did our conferences, and we both said, oh, they're always asking me how tough it must have been to shoot these scenes. The good thing was, though, that we did have a lot of fun. I think we felt like it was, you know, a very good collaboration between Jude and I and Kareem, and also we kind of had to escape these very tragic and horrific, you know, moments in our work, and it was nice that it was a sudden ease to the working process.
I think you read some of the writings of Catherine Parr. And as you said, Catherine Parr is famous for having been a published author in English and being a British queen. So were they full of sedition, or were they thoughts about religion, or what did she write about?
A lot of them that are like psalms, you know, words to God. But then there are also, you know, much more like political ideals and how to live, you know, a certain like Christian lives. And I think that's in those texts I found, you know, that was where I found the most inspiration, I think. And actually, maybe even most when she started to talk about, you know, which kind of surprised me, jumped off the page when she, who has been, you know, told to be this extremely, you know, almost like put on a pedestal to being a very good woman. And when she starts to talk about the petty people and kind of put herself on very high horses or talk about the money that she likes to spend on fabrics, that was kind of when I smiled and I was like, see, she's also just a human being. And suddenly it felt like I got closer in one way to a woman who lived 500 years ago. And, you know, obviously she's had her background and she's been, you know, grown up in a certain kind of world and universe and haven't seen other things, even though she has very clever ideas, you know. So I think that's when, in the same way that I hear Jude talk about, you know, wanting to humanize his beast, that's kind of how I felt when I read her text. And, you know, I would say that most people don't know that she's the first ever woman published. I mean, I didn't, and it seemed like a lot of, at least my British friends, none of them really knew.
Now, she is a very good mother, and she's bringing together the children of three of the wives of Henry VIII, one Catholic and two Protestant, and one of them being, of course, Elizabeth I. And she just begins to mother them and not make the divisions maybe that her their father makes.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, you know, I can just imagine that it's a pretty powerful force of nature when I think a woman might have a longing to have a child. And if you go back to this time and being a queen, like the one and big and only reason you put on this earth is to create more children, or in this case, even create an heir. And she never had children in her life. And that to me was also this kind of gap in the history I was trying to figure out, you know, because that must have been, you know, a pretty big weight on her shoulder. And then to instead see these children and obviously knowing and can see the situation they're at and trying to navigate them in their loss of mothers and having to be children of this very, you know, known tyrant. That was obviously a lot of my inspiration there, imagining what it must have taken for her to raise these children almost like they were her own.
Alicia, thank you so much for talking to Arena.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you.
Alicia Vikander there speaking to Kay Sheehy about the film Firebrand, which we will be reviewing on Thursday night's programme. New documentary, Don't Forget to Remember, delves into the realities of living with Alzheimer's. Filmmaker Ross Killeen was in part inspired by his own experiences with his mother's dementia. Collaborating, however, with renowned street artist Asbestos and telling the story of his mother, Helena, the documentary explores the power of memory, art and family in the face of loss. Ahead of its nationwide release this Friday, delighted to be joined in studio this evening by Ross Killeen to tell us more about the film itself. It does, in some ways, you didn't make a film about your own mother's dementia directly, I don't think, Ross, but here you are making it about somebody else's mother. Tell me a little bit about that journey, if you like.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, Don't Forget to Remember is a feature documentary. It's about an artist, Asbestos, trying to come to terms with his own mother's Alzheimer's diagnosis. Mm. It's about his family, the fragility of memory and the process of artist healing. But while it's about his family, it's kind of about my family too. Everything you see in the film is something that I went through with my dad, my sister, my brother, and of course my mum. And I've no doubt it's the same story for many families around the country who are going through this or connected with this.
Was that a big driving force in the making of the film? Because this is Alzheimer's Awareness Month as well, isn't it, September? And the fact that you're releasing it at this point of time, was that a big part of the reasoning behind it?
Absolutely. It's World Alzheimer's Month this September, and we want to get the film out across the country as much as possible. We're screening it in many cities around the country. Ironically, it's my mum's 50 year anniversary at the end of this month, so it feels serendipitous to be doing it at this time, but or poignant to be doing it at this time. But I collaborated with Asbestos. I directed it, and we worked together on it.
And the starting of that collaboration and the meeting with Asbestos and the decision to tell the story of his family. Mm. When did that come about?
So I knew Asbestos for many years, and we'd worked together on some small projects, but hadn't worked on anything as substantial as this before. Mm. And we met post-COVID and bumped into each other on the street, hadn't seen him in a while, and did the usual how have you been kind of conversation. And he told me about his mum's Alzheimer's diagnosis, and we just started talking about it, and I told him about what I'd been through, and I realised that I hadn't really talked about it much. Very much a conversation killer, you know. People don't really want to talk about it. Mm. Something people find very difficult to talk about. Something that I probably found very difficult to talk about. Maybe I didn't want to talk about it. But we kind of kept the conversations going between us, and we realized that we were benefiting from this, just talking about our own experiences. And we decided we'd try and make something together to collaborate on a project that dealt with this subject in an artistic way, and that would try to open up conversations and encourage people to talk.
Let's have a listen to a clip. This is from quite early on in the film. There's a recurring motif of asbestos, of his mother Helena and his father Matt doing the crossword together. And it's generally the father is trying to prod or elicit the word, whatever, the solution to the clue from Helena. And that's where this clip starts.
A woman in relation to her child. What would you call it? What would you call the woman that was related to a child? Starts with a name.
What's been happening to my mum is shocking and scary. I'm both experiencing it, but also almost observing it as well, and it kind of feels distant at times.
Losing your memory is like watching a bullet in slow-mo for years coming towards you and you can't avoid it. So much is actually about recounting memory and about shared memories.
And only with your memories are you able to kind of construct who you are.
And that's a clip from quite close to the opening of the documentary film we're speaking about this evening, Don't Forget to Remember, directed by Ross Killeen, and telling the story of the street artist Asbestos and his mother's Alzheimer's diagnosis. It gives us a sense just of the tone of the film. It's incredibly gentle, but it brings us right into the kitchen. And yeah. At times into the therapy room, even with Helena, and sometimes with Matt, the husband present as well. That's a very delicate. I know you're saying this is something that's not spoken about, but how did you balance that? You know, the privacy, the respect that was needed to be in those rooms with telling the story and not sugarcoating it.
Well, not sugarcoating it was something we really wanted to do, but also, you know, we wanted to make something very dignified and respectful as well. And there are three layers to the film. The first was really to be in the room and show that routine of caring for someone. You know, like I said, kind of went through that with my dad and my mum and observing that. And, you know, to me, that's true love, you know, to care for someone. And we wanted to show that. Obviously, it's isolating. It can be lonely. There's frustration, but there's also love and commitment. And we wanted to find hope and light in this subject. The second part of the film is really following the artist's process and following Asbestos and what he's doing from ideation through to the process of doing the chalkboards and working with the chalk, and then putting them out into the open and at the mercy of the public and the elements to see what happens to them. And then the third was to really give Helena a strong voice in the film, because when people get dementia or Alzheimer's, they lose their memories, but they can be forgotten, you know. Mm. They can very quickly be forgotten, and we wanted to retrieve those memories as much as possible while we could and celebrate her life.
You touch on the artistic aspect being that, if you like, the second layer within it. In fact, the title, Don't Forget to Remember, was this something that you had just jotted at one point when experiencing asbestos, the art of asbestos?
Yeah.
We need to realise the sort of work that he makes and Let's Be Destroyed and how that works.
Yeah, it's kind of a long story. I hope we have time for it. But he was doing an exhibition in Hugh Lane, which was you were invited into a room and you were surrounded by three drawings, chalk drawings on blackboards of his mother and her memories. And I was one of the first people who went in. This was before we made the film. Mm. I was one of the first people to go into the room, and you're faced with these three drawings, and there's some chalk there and a duster, and you were invited to either wipe them away or to add to them with the chalk. Only catch is that the artist is actually standing there watching you doing it.
Yeah.
And not only is he standing there, but he's standing there with this mirror mask, cube-shaped mask on his head. So when you look at him, you're looking at yourself. So it's all very disorientating and quite strange. But I stood up at one of the drawings, beautiful drawing of his mother. And like I said, I was one of the first people to go in, so it hadn't been altered or affected at all. It was perfect. And I found it very hard to rub it out. And then I had the chalk. I was like, well, I'll add something to it. But then I was like, I don't really know what to do here, you know. So I just came to me and I just wrote, "Don't forget to remember," in the corner and just walked out. And a week later, as Bessas rang me, and he said behind the mask, he was very emotional when he saw that. And, you know, it really made him think about what the chalk was all about, you know, and what this whole process he was doing. Funny thing was, the next person who came into the room just wiped it off. So it just, that was the kind of start of the project. And that was the genesis of it, I suppose, the origin of it.
And then what we see happening through the film is a series of chalk on blackboard drawings that asbestos makes, mostly based on old family photographs and pictures of Helena, pictures of asbestos as a young boy, his brother, pictures of the family together, holidays, all that type of thing. These are then put up. He goes around the city with his mother, nails them all into walls where obviously it's going to rain.
Yeah.
Where sometimes it and there's a duster and chalk beside it. So he's inviting the memories to be, or these, the chalk boards to be cleaned, wiped clean.
Yeah. Well, the chalk is a metaphor for how fragile our memories are. You know, and we want, like, the memories can't be destroyed as long as we share them, as long as we continue to talk about
them. They can be rubbed away, but they're not destroyed.
They can be rubbed away, they can be altered, they can change, but they can never be destroyed because they live on. And I was horrified when, you know, I watched asbestos making these beautiful drawings and I watched the whole process of it. And then he just puts them up in the street and he was like, brilliant, they're being destroyed. And I was like, oh my God, this is awful, you know. But there's beauty in that, letting go of these. And they aren't actually... Someone actually said recently that they're just chalk drawings of photographs, you know. So they're not, we're not destroying the original photographs. They're just representations of the photographs.
Yeah, and we're also not destroying the memories.
And we're not destroying the memories. And asbestos, the process of, you know, revisiting these memories, going through the photo albums, having the conversations with his mum and dad and his brother, you know, brings those memories back to life again, you know.
Yeah, so. And the other aspect of it is that you also see... him showing the pictures, the chalk drawings to his mother and father at one point, deeply moving that scene. But there's a recurring motif, because it is very funny in places as well. Recurring motif, every time Helena sees a picture of asbestos as a young boy, she laughs.
Yeah. I know, this is kind of saying, we want to find kind of hope and some light in this. Like, it's no doubt, it's a sad situation, but there is hope and levity in the film. And Helena, strangely, is in a kind of a present tense, you know, and in a way, Matt says it in the film, that
Matt, the father.
The father, who's an amazing human being who does everything for her and loves her deeply. And you can just see the commitment is unwavering throughout the film. And... you know, it's not just the person who gets dementia or Alzheimer's, it's the whole family, and everyone around has to kind of, is affected just as much nearly, you know. So, I do hope people can go along and see it. It's been released this Friday.
This Friday, Ross Killeen there, don't forget to remember the title of the film that Ross is telling us about. Selected cinemas across the country from this Friday, September the 6th.
From this Friday, September 6th, yeah. And like I said, World Alzheimer's Month, so hoping to get as many people to see it. Don't forget to remember film.com. Information on all the screenings.
And don't forget to remember the film in the process.
Don't forget to remember the film.
Well, thanks very much, Ross. That is, as I say, Ross Killeen. That is our lot for this Monday evening. Leah Murphy researched. Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTE Radio 1. And Ray Cudahy will be with you after the news.